All right, now it's time for Ask an Astronomer with Dr. Tim O'Brien. Thanks again for answering these questions, which are a step above our usual sort of questions we have.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear. The first question comes from Andrew, and the question is, I've heard the moon is slowly moving away from the Earth. Will it one day float off into space or collide with the sun?
Interesting question. Well, yeah, absolutely, he's absolutely right. The moon is moving away from the Earth. The average distance from the moon to the Earth is about 385,000 kilometres, but that separation is actually increasing at a rate of about 3.8 centimetres a year.
So small distance, but still measurable. And
well, as a percentage of the distance to the moon, it's certainly a small change. But in fact, you know, we can all imagine what 3.8 centimetres is. It's not unimaginably small. And in fact, it's interesting how that's measured. The first person we think to make an estimate of the distance to the moon was a guy called Eratosthenes, an ancient Greek who did it using sort of shadows and sticks and wells and so on. People can read about that if they like. But these days we've improved the accuracy of the measurements quite a lot, and the technique actually relies on using reflectors that are placed on the moon, and they were placed there by mainly by the Apollo astronauts. So it's a nice proof, actually, that we did actually go to the moon.
They did actually land on the moon.
Yeah, because yes. they left these things called retro reflectors behind, which are positioned so that you can basically fire a laser beam from the Earth onto one of these reflectors, and then this thing, it sort of bounces back off the reflector, and we pick up the sort of reflection from it, and we time how long it takes the signal to get to the moon and back, and therefore, because we know the speed of light, we can work out the distance. That's how the most accurate measurements are made. And in fact, the sort of current most accurate system is actually, its name arises from Apollo. They use the acronym Apollo, which is Apache Point Observatory Lunar Laser Ranging Operation.
Super.
Not at all contrived. it's actually the Apache Point Observatory in America. It's actually run by the University of California at San Diego. And they're actually hoping to make measurements that are accurate to a few millimetres.
Wow.
Because the problem is, there's a problem to do with, you know, you can imagine you send this laser beam all the way to the moon, and as it goes, it sort of spreads out. It's quite large when it hits the moon. I think it's something like 7 kilometres or so across when it actually hits the moon.
Mm.
And then reflects, so part of, some of those photons in that laser beam hit the reflector and come back towards us. And by the time they get back to the Earth, it's something like 20 kilometres across.
Right.
Sort of pool of light that's been reflected. So you can imagine all these photons are spread out. The signal is very, very faint.
They must use a very powerful laser to.
It's very interesting. Some very nice pictures of it on the web, actually. And we should stick some on our Jodcast website as well to go with it. But the signal's weak, and things like the atmosphere and so on cause a bit of a cause uncertainty in that signal. But yeah, this most recent setup hopes to measure that to an accuracy of a millimeter or so, which is incredible, really. Now, we mentioned that actually the distance is increasing by several centimetres a year, 3.8 centimetres a year on average, and that's largely due to the sort of tidal interaction between the moon and the Earth. So the moon raises tides in the oceans, although it does actually distort the shape of the solid Earth as well, slightly.
Right.
But it's mostly affected by it mostly affects the oceans. Obviously, being fluids, they're more easily distorted. So you get these sort of tidal bulges that rotate around the Earth as the Earth spins, and that sort of, you get tidal friction, which slows down the Earth's rotation by maybe a few milliseconds every 100 years, and it also sort of it takes energy away from the Earth's rotation, sort of puts it into the Moon's orbit. So it turns out that the orbit of the Moon is increasing by that amount every year. So gradually the Moon is drifting away from the Earth. That's true.
So what's happening here is that the tides moving around the Earth are slowing the Earth down? Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So it's
and in also speeding the Moon up, going around its orbit?
Well, it's actually, the orbit actually, the size of the Moon's orbit increases. So I think we've defined that the Moon is moving away from the Earth. The question was it going to drift off into space and collide with the Sun? The answer to that is probably not. I mean, if it kept drifting away from it gradually, if you work out how long it would take for it to drift a long way away from the Earth at 3.8 centimetres a year, it's not going very far very fast.
Right.
So it's not likely to sort of drift off and crash into the Sun. I mean, at some point, if you could imagine this happening, if it was happening faster, I guess it'd eventually get taken over by the gravitational pull of some other planet or the Sun. It'd end up in orbit around the Sun, you know, rather than in orbit around the Earth. But that wouldn't, you know, the rate it's happening, this is so far in the future, the sun would have expanded to become a red giant and incinerated the Earth and the Moon anyway by that point, I think. So nothing particular to worry about there. I mean, just going back to these laser ranging reflectors that sort of measure the distance to the Moon, the reason they're wanting to get this high precision is not just because of trying to understand this interaction between the Moon and the Earth. It's actually to test general relativity as well, which is, you know, Einstein's theory of gravity.
Right.
So
it isn't just a technological, you know, trick or something fun to do.
Yeah, no, it is a proper physics experiment. So hoping to basically find a point at which maybe Einstein's theory breaks down, and you have to make these measurements with incredible precision to do that.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for that answer. I hope that answers the question. I think it does. Next question comes from Mike in the US. He noted that in a previous episode of the Jodcast that many stars in the universe are cooler than our own sun. And he's curious to know whether we know how many stars are larger and how many stars are smaller than our sun.
Okay, so this is interesting. I mean, I've done a little bit of research to find out the answer to this question, but I must admit I probably don't answer his question entirely fully, but but hopefully this will help a little bit. Basically, there's sort of the way to do this, the common way this is done, and where my statement in the earlier Jodcast came from really, is to look at something called a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, or sometimes a colour magnitude diagram, where you sort of look at the sky, you look at a sample of stars, and you measure the brightnesses, which is the magnitudes in sort of traditional visual astronomy, and you look at the colours, which basically means looking at the sort of ratio of brightnesses at two different wavelengths. And then what you do is you take those measurements, so for each star you've measured its colour and you've measured its brightness, and then you plot one against the other. So you have a graph that sort of shows you brightness on the vertical axis against colour on the horizontal axis. And traditionally you have brightness with the brighter things at the top, and you have colour with the redder things at the right and the bluer things at the left of the diagram. Now, you know, when this was originally done, it wasn't really clear what this all meant. And when you do an experiment like that, you might be disappointed. You might think, okay, I'm going to make these measurements, I'm going to make this, draw this diagram. You might be a bit disappointed to find that what you get is something we call a scatter diagram,
right,
which is all the points just scatter randomly across this plane, and it's not taught you anything at all about the things you're studying. That didn't happen in that case. When that diagram was first made by Messrs. Hertzsprung and Russell, they found you didn't get a scatter diagram. In fact, 90% of the stars that they looked at lay in a diagonal line across this diagram. We call that the main sequence, and we now know that's the sort of basically because stars spend 90% of their life burning hydrogen to helium at the cores, and they lie along that line.
So that's where most of the stars sit.
That's where most of the stars sit, yeah. And the sun is roughly in the middle of that. It turns out where you lie on that diagonal line is all to do with the mass of the star. So the higher mass stars are hotter and brighter, and so they're at top left of this diagonal line, and the lower mass stars are cooler, redder and fainter, so they're at bottom right of this line. So the question really is asking to quantify a little bit where we are along that diagonal line, I guess. Now, if you do that experiment, for example, if we sat here with a telescope, we could do it ourselves from our back gardens, maybe with a little CCD camera or something, and make these measurements ourselves, we'd probably pick, you know, maybe 100 stars or 1,000 stars or something. If we went round the sky picking, say, the 1,000 brightest stars, then what you'd find, in fact, is your results were biased, and they'd be biased because the 1,000 brightest stars would actually select some of the intrinsically brightest stars. So these might be stars that are sort of seen a long way away across the galaxy, and they're intrinsically bright because they're sort of big, typically. Like red giants are quite bright because they're large, or also because they're hot. The hotter a star is, the brighter it is. And that's a bias, because what you want to do is you want to answer the question and say, well, what's the, you know, typical properties of a star, not these sort of extreme objects that are incredibly bright you see a long distance away. So what you really want to do is you want to say, rather than pick the 1,000 brightest stars, you want to pick the 1,000 nearest stars, let's say.
Right.
That would be a less biased observation, because then you just, all you're doing then is you're saying, okay, the bias in that sense is they're the stars closest to the sun, and maybe you'd be unlucky in the region closest to the sun in the Milky Way might be unusual for some other reason, chemical composition or something.
But you like to assume that the nearest stars are just a typical mix of stars.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a sort of random selection because it just happens to be where the sun is. So that's the best thing to do. And in fact, what I've done, just to try and answer the question and quantify it a little bit, what I did was to take from the Hipparchos database. Hipparchos was a satellite that measured the positions of stars very, very accurately. It also used this thing called parallax. Mm-hmm. Whether they want to explain parallax or not, possibly not. Maybe another time.
Maybe another time. We'll discuss what parallax is. But it's essentially a measure of distance, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very accurate way to measure the distance to something. So we got the distances very accurately, which means you can then work out their intrinsic brightnesses very accurately. Because the problem is if something's farther away, it looks fainter. Mm. So if we get the distance very accurately, we can get the brightness very accurately. So what we do then is we can sort of count the number of stars against their actual brightness. And because their actual brightness relates, as I've said, to the size and the temperature, that's basically answering the question that we've been asked. What I did was look at all the stars within 10 parsecs of the Sun, which is sort of 30 light years or so of the Sun. So this is a region of space relatively close to the Sun. And I got something like 30 stars being brighter than the Sun.
Okay.
And about 130 stars or so being fainter than the Sun.
Right, so roughly four times as many stars are fainter than the Sun.
Mm. Yeah. So that brightness, that faintness, is a function of both the size and the temperature, actually.
Right.
So, you know, I haven't disentangled those two things, so I haven't fully answered the question, but I think it's a reasonable start. It just shows you that, you know, a good proportion more stars are fainter than the Sun than are brighter than the Sun.
Right. Brilliant, thank you very much.
Okay, no problem.